Hey there, this is Dan Delta Collins. You're listening to Wandering DMs. Wandering DMs is broadcast live every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time on twitch.tv/wanderingdms and also youtube.com/wanderingdms. And now, we hope you enjoy the show.
Welcome to Wandering DMs. I'm Paul.
And I'm Dan. And on this episode of Wandering DMs, Paul, where are we wandering this
week?
We're
in PAX East.
Oh my
goodness.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm personally surprised.
We were not expecting to be here, so this is very unusual.
Yeah, kind of surprise. Nice trip here in Boston, Massachusetts Convention Center. This is my first day at PAX East. So I've been wandering around going, wow, this is rather significantly large.
Yeah, it's definitely, I've been here a few times in the past in another life as a video game developer.
Yes.
So I've definitely, I've worked booths here, I've just come as an attendee, all manner of stuff. I've been here as an indie, but it never for anything tabletop related.
Yeah, so obviously PAX East is mostly video game oriented, is what most people are here for. I actually was surprised by how many tabletop game there are. So we're actually standing in the board game area at the moment, and at least a couple of the aisles here at the expo are board game table related, dice manufacturers, game table manufacturers. We get to speak with the people at Dwarven Forge here this morning. So it's more sizable than I would have expected.
Yeah, and I think it's grown over the years. I think we've had more tabletop stuff here at PAX East than we have had in the past. I've watched it grow over many, many years. And also, like, it's not just confined to this one end of the convention center anymore.
Right.
As we wandered the main expo floor, we would see a lot of tabletop booths kind of interspersed amongst the video game developers.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's pretty interesting.
It is. It's, I mean, among the things that struck me is just like, wow, you know, dice is a big business now.
Yeah.
There's a lot of manufacturers selling a lot of dice, and apparently that's a good business now.
There's a fair trade, I think, in custom dice. A lot of folks are making like very fancy custom high end dice. I think that's a big thing.
Yeah. And as I said to you as we were walking around, so just last week John Peterson had a video about how to identify different manufacturers, different brands of dice in the 70s.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't that long a video because there were two manufacturers throughout the entire decade.
Yeah.
And some people would actually buy them and then repackage and resell them under different names, but there were basically just two manufacturers. Now there's 2,000.
Yeah. So a little bit of a background here. The interesting thing is that Dan, you and I met by working together at a video game company, right? Many years ago.
Correct. That was our original. Those were both of our original careers.
Yep.
Paul, you're still in that industry today.
I am.
I moved out of that. My partner Isabel. Disinvited Brooklyn artist Isabel Carfani on the show. We also met while we were in video games at the time. So that was what we all thought we were going to be doing for a career.
Well, there's a lot of crossover between video games and tabletop.
Right.
And frankly, I remember when I graduated college, I thought that I was probably going to work in tech. I actually graduated with a degree in creative writing, but thought I was gonna, you know, make my money working in software.
Yeah.
And was very much considering moving out west and going to work for some .com that was gonna blow up in 1 year.
Yep.
And the thing that kept me out here on the East Coast is I remember going to Gen Con and seeing this company, Genetic Anomalies, which is where you and I ended up working together.
Right.
And what really grabbed me about it is that they were blending video games and tabletop.
Yes.
Right? They were doing an online CCG. This is in 1999.
Yes.
The first online CCG, as far as I'm aware. And I was like, this is amazing. I want to be a part of this.
Yeah.
And I basically banged on the door until they let me in.
Correct. And I was coming, I'd gotten started just a couple years before you did at a company called Papyrus Design Group here in Boston. So we met here in Boston. So I was at Papyrus Design Group doing Papyrus racing, things like IndyCar racing and NASCAR racing. And I moved to Genetic Anomalies from there. And then you came on board, like I think a year after I arrived there. And obviously the thing that company was aiming for was you know, can I say this? Is this? What? I guess I can say it. Well, I mean, really, I mean, we were trying to get Magic the Gathering online.
Right, right. Right. Yep, this was before Magic the Gathering online existed
exactly.
as a product.
Exactly. Yep. So there was a point where our company and a second company were both pitching to Wizards of the Coast. We can do a really good job with Magic the Gathering online. We had a science fiction card game called Cron X as sort of as a prototype. It was an ongoing business. It was making money and had thousands of players, and missed it by that much. And we would have if that had been the case, we would have been basically the main engineering team on Magic the Gathering Online. We missed it by about 3 inches.
Oh well.
Yeah.
Such is the way the cookie crumbles.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Unfortunately, yeah. Video game industry is definitely a volatile one.
It is.
And there's. Yeah. 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 I've had my fair number of hits and misses.
Right.
Probably more misses.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
I don't know. I've always been intrigued though, and always been drawn to companies that are interested in kind of taking influence from tabletop or blurring the line between tabletop and virtual. I think that's really fascinating stuff. And I love that stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. And pretty much everyone we know that works in video games. So if it is not obvious, we're taking this opportunity for us at PAX East to talk about video games which is not something we normally do. But it has been our careers, and we ping pong between both commonly. And of course, my primary thesis, I don't know how much I verbalize it, but it's in my head all the time, is that the relationship between movies and theater is the same as the relationship between video games and tabletop games.
Interesting. Yeah.
Is, to my understanding, the really top end, what are movies? Well, it's a large business. It's an entertainment that's easily packaged and redistributed on a massive scale, right? Mm-hmm. But to my understanding, the top level movie stars, what they would really like to do is they'd like to spend their time in live theater for a one of a kind, right? This only happens, this crazy accident that happened live in front of the live audience is only ever going to happen once. And the risk and the liveness and the energy is much more emotionally compelling than the packaged product that gets cut up and chopped and put together by an editor.
I see.
I think that relationship is exactly the same between video games and tabletop games, is that everybody that I knew that worked in video games, and there's more money there, and it's easier to mass distribute it. What did we spend our time, our own time after hours, is we would sit down and we would play D&D.
Yep, for sure.
And I think that, it was somewhat for us a little bit more emotionally charged. And we were just talking to someone else who has a stream and said that, the live game is really their preferred, their preferred thing to engage in. And so for people that are aware of that movie theater relationship, that's what I usually say is the video game role-playing game situation is basically the same thing.
I know certainly when I talk to folks about what it's like to work in video games, a lot of times I'll say, well, it's a blend of the entertainment industry and the software industry.
Yeah.
And a lot of times, if you think it's super glamorous to go work in video games, if you come into a video game office and just for the day-to-day and just sort of look at what we're doing by the day, it looks a lot like software development, right? Like it's not, it's a bunch of people in cubicles working, sometimes we get up on a whiteboard and draw some stuff, but it's very much like software development. On the other hand, economically, I think we're much more like the entertainment industry, where it's very hit-driven and companies come and go very quickly, and it's all about what is the next big project and is it going to hit?
Yeah.
And that's what everybody's looking for.
Those are the exact words I was going to use too. Is it is, and of course we've heard that from our business leaders for years and years. Mm-hmm. Is you do need. I mean, of course, when I started, Christmas was the big thing. Now now there's streaming and online and mobile, of course. But we had to hit that Thanksgiving date to manufacture the discs and get it in the stores for the Christmas season. Mm. I think we could wrap like 1 week before Thanksgiving, and then it would be in the stores the week after Thanksgiving. And the companies are volatile, and I think that every company that I worked at existed for about 2 years after I left. And you'll put a lot of resources, actually more more time than even a movie. So most movies take about a year to make. Most, you know, A-list video games take 2 or 3 years to put together. And so in some sense, you've actually put more resources into it, really hoping that it's a big hit. And either you're going to succeed and very quickly get bought out by a larger player, or you're going to get tanked.
It's pretty fair.
Yeah,
I think.
Yeah.
Definitely been through my fair share of closures,
right,
and chaos, and, you know, also worked on a game that was pretty darn successful.
Yeah.
And, you know, got to enjoy that for a long while. So that's, yeah, it's pretty fair.
I have a little bit more distance on this now that I've been. So obviously I've been out of the industry for a number of years, and I've been a college teacher since then. But you know, that having been said, it is the best when you've got, you know, tens of thousands of people around the world, you know, playing your game, and you're getting feedback about that. And people still recognize me from back when I was at Papyrus. So there are some people that still today, years and years later, will go, "Oh my God, you worked on Grand Prix Legends at Papyrus. Tell me about that."
That's a
pretty good jolt when you get people appreciating the work that you put into something.
Nice.
Yeah.
Nice. I was gonna say. Oh no, I've lost my train of thought. Oh, derailed. Completely derailed.
Sorry.
That's all right. Nope. What? Hit me with something else, because I'm derailed.
Okay. How much has that? So we started playing D&D together back when we were first video game colleagues.
Yep.
And then we were like, hey, we should start a D&D game after hours, and we started our first campaign together after hours at Genetic Anomalies, as a matter of fact, and. That was my last game job, actually. Has that continued for you? Have you continued to have D&D groups at the companies
you
work at?
Yep. Absolutely. And that's one of the fun things about working in a video game industry, is it is so enmeshed in tabletop that I think that, you know, the fandoms really cross. The employees who are attracted to a video game company all tend to be gamers,
right,
and tabletop gamers.
Right.
So I think one joke I made at one point was that asking a group of video game developers, have you ever played D&D, is a foolish question.
Right.
Right. The real question is, what edition of D&D do you play?
Okay. Yeah.
Because
okay. They
all play.
Okay.
They all
yeah.
play.
Yeah.
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 Yeah. And I've even had cases. I've run games at my company for, as an after hours, hey, who wants to play D&D? And I have occasionally run a beginner-friendly, hey, you've not gotten a chance to play before,
okay,
let me introduce you to the game, and actually got a fair amount of traction with those, because
okay,
the couple of people at the company who had never played were actually ashamed
right.
of
that right.
not having played.
Right.
And we're
right.
like, oh, good, oh,
right.
thank you, I
right.
want this opportunity to come
right.
in and experience this
right.
thing that I'm embarrassed
right.
to not have never experienced.
And rightfully so.
So, yeah, it is really permeated. Honestly, I think most of my D&D campaigns have largely been assembled from people I work with.
Great.
We were just talking, I think, recently about my first toe in the water with old school gaming back in 2010, which was with our mutual friend BJ,
yep.
and
yep.
then a bunch of people I was working with at that time.
Yeah.
That BJ
right.
was interestingly the outlier in that
right.
we weren't working together, although he is also in video game development.
Yep.
So, yeah, we were all video game
right,
developers.
Right, right, right. So I think it's interesting that, we're making our living in video games, and then you turn around and using our own free time mm-hmm. to do more gaming, but to do it live on the tabletop.
Yeah.
I think how many times, like, how much has actual mechanics or dynamics fed into the video game design work? We've done.
You know, there's certain mechanics that we are
yeah.
so accustomed to that we don't realize really were introduced by tabletop games, right?
Right.
Like the very concept of hit points
right.
comes from
right.
D&D.
Right.
And, you know, you look back all the way back at, like, I was going to say Quake, what came before Quake, Doom, right?
Yeah.
Where you actually had health points.
Right.
And I think that is ultimately drawing on D&D, right?
Yes. Yeah, I agree.
Concept that
and,
was introduced.
And also
there.
Levels.
Levels. Yep.
Right.
Levels.
And also levels, which might be the single, you know, biggest, I think, you know, invention in, you know, coming out of D&D. And now everybody expects, you know, everybody knows what a level is or what it means
yeah.
to level your character.
Yeah. And now we have the sort of Aurora Boris effect of games that are now trying to emulate tabletop, right? So we were talking earlier about actual like D&D themed games we have played in the past.
Yeah.
What was your first D&D video game that you played?
Okay, so my cousins had a Commodore 64, and they had a game. Okay, well, Adventure.
Adventure.
Okay. Yep. So Atari 2600. I had the advent. You know, it came. It came with combat. The first thing I got is I said, folks, I want an Atari and I want Adventure.
Nice.
And so of course Adventure was an 8-bit, very highly pixelated. The player was a square. Right. And you had things would move on the screen, but they didn't have any articulature. Right, so there were these very poorly drawn dragons that kind of looked like ducks that would be like, right? And if you were lucky, you could pick up the sword that looked like an arrow, and if you stuck it, they'd get X's in their eyes and they'd stop moving.
Nice.
And I played a crap load of Adventure, and it had a lot of really interesting things to it, and there was a maze that used memory in a clever way that was incredibly hard to get around. And a culminating maze where there were light dynamics were an issue, and I played a crap load out of that actually. So Adventure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I remember playing a lot of the text-based adventure games. I want to say there was like a wizardry game that I played back in the day.
That's
the
one Sierra Online, right? Is it?
No. I can't remember.
Okay.
It, honestly.
Okay.
Lost into the mists of a very very young Paul playing computer games. The one that really sticks out in my memory, Enchanter. Yes.
Okay,
thank you. That's the one. The one that sticks out really in my memory though is when we get into the Goldbox Sierra Online era of games.
Okay.
Because that's the first game I bought with my own money. I remember seeing an ad in a Dragon magazine for Pool of Radiance, and saving up my money so I could go down to the electronics boutique and pay $55. I remember the price.
Yeah.
Which was a lot of money back then. Yeah. It's for some reason still about the price of a video game. That hasn't changed.
Yeah, that's
in like
a weird thing about
years.
The AAA game industry. Yeah.
Yeah. I remember.
Wow.
I played that game to death. I played that game on an 8086, and I played that game on a Tandy 16, and I played that game on a Commodore 64. You could get it on Commodore 64 back then.
I never played the Goldbox game, and actually, I should play fair with myself and say I should be rightfully ashamed of not playing that actually, because that was pretty influential.
Yeah.
That's quite a bit of money for a young kid back at that time.
It was.
You had
to
be really committed and dedicated to go pursue that.
I remember saving up for a long time to get that,
yeah.
And then I remember customizing my characters again. You have little pixelated, horrible, like, oh, I want this shade of teal instead of
that shade
of teal for his sword or his.
I didn't have a PC until I was actually like a sophomore in college.
Hmm.
So I had an Atari 2600 as a kid, and then pretty early on I had a TRS-80 color computer. Some people call it a trash 80. I spent a lot of time on that thing. And so I did somehow, I got an 8-inch floppy disk of Zork that I could take into junior high school, right? And I played quite a bit of Zork 1. So it's chopped up into three pieces to get on the disc. So I played quite a bit of Zork 1, and I made like a poster-sized map as I explored the regions of Zork 1. My cousins had a Commodore 64.
The Infocom?
Yes.
The Infocom? Yeah. Was that, I'm trying to remember. I remember Steve Moretzky worked on the Zork series. I don't remember if he was Zork 1 or not, but he was certainly involved in Zork.
Really? Okay.
I got to work with him later in my career
at
Floodgate Entertainment.
Really?
And was just awed at, like, oh my, you know, there's a, I don't know, it was just amazing. Like, oh my God, Steve Moretzky worked on Zork games.
I think it would like existed initially, there was a version like on college, you know, mainframes.
Yeah.
And then it got chopped up to for a PC game.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's text-based, obviously, and I like Zork quite a bit. Didn't get very far through it, frankly. I mean, those puzzles are really hard. And I actually didn't make a huge amount of headway. And then my cousins had a Commodore 64, and they had a game called Temple of Apshai. And that really caught my imagination when I was over there at their place. I would play that quite a bit.
So speaking of Steve Moretzky, I'm reminded that like there was a fair number of sort of early era tabletop game designers who then eventually made the shift over to video games.
Yes.
And always being surprised at, again, video game companies being made largely of people who are really into this stuff.
Yeah.
There was always the chance that you were going to end up working with, you know, some hero of your childhood.
Right. Right.
I definitely remember that happening.
Right.
I mean, frankly, I was drawn to 38 Studios because I heard the name Ari Salvatore, and I was like, hell yeah, I want to be involved in that.
Yeah. Great. Great.
Can you think of other cases where that
happened? I had a friend of mine that introduced me to Dave Cook, actually. So I had the opportunity a couple years ago to have dinner with Dave Cook. That's how his career went, right? Mm-hmm. So once he left TSR, he became a dedicated writer-designer for video game companies. And when you do that, again, the companies are volatile. So he was talking about he and his wife, you know, regularly moving around the country.
Yep.
So about every 2 or 3 years, they would pick up their household, probably switch coasts to a different company, and that's what his career had been up to that point for probably about 2 decades then when I spoke to him. Yeah. So it's and he admitted a lot more money in that than when he was actually doing paper tabletop stuff.
Yep.
And of course, just to be clear, Dave Cook tended to do editorial, you know, he did a lot of great modules that he wrote, Expert Module X4, X5, the Desert Nomad series, which is really famous, he did. And he edited the Expert, you know, the BX Expert book, and then he was also the main name on AD&D 2nd Edition.
Nice.
So he tended to do a lot of work of cleaning up Gygax's creative, messy stuff. So Cook spent a lot of time doing that.
Right.
And did a really good job with it. So I've really been impressed by his stuff.
So when I was at 38, we also eventually had on the docket Ken Ralston, who worked on the Paranoia game.
Right.
And I think that's how I originally recognized his name. But I remember at the time, so that's right around when I was starting to get an old school D&D. And I went back and was rereading Dragon Magazine from like issue one.
Yeah.
And I actually like stumbled on an article that he wrote that was like his account of playing in a tournament game in like the late 70s or early 80s.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was like, oh my God. That's...
Those are really funny. When you get those magazines and you read those little snippets by someone before they get famous.
Yeah, yeah.
And there's a couple things, I think, by J. Eric Holmes like that that are really, really fun to discover like that.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
So why did you not start with the strategic review issues?
I think I might have.
Oh, okay, actually.
I think I might have. What are there, like all four issues of
seven.
That or something?
Seven?
Seven. I think I might have.
Okay.
Yeah.
Good.
Yeah.
Good. Good, we avoided. Avoided that. Yeah, right. So so you're pointing out that Dave Cook worked on the Fallout series.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I will point out that disinvited artist Isabella Garbani worked at Looking Glass, where they made Thief originally.
Yep.
Right.
Yep.
Yep.
I also remember there was a school that it was one of the first schools to have a video game development curriculum down in Florida.
Okay.
Whose name is struggling to enter my brain right now. But famously, Dave Arneson taught there at the end of his life.
Right, right, right.
And I remember I was interviewing people who would come up and be like, "Oh yeah, I took class with Dave Arneson."
Okay, okay. So let's talk about that actually. Yeah. So we were walking around and we were talking about that, about how do you get into, you know, video games. And so obviously when I started, dedicated game programs did not exist. I have a math degree and I have a philosophy degree.
Yeah.
Do not even have a computer degree, but I was hired, I actually did always take programming courses all the way through college as electives. So I was hired at Papyrus out of college based on the strength of that. You also don't have a computing degree.
Correct, correct.
Yeah.
Honestly, it was always a point of, originally a point of embarrassment for me that when I was trying to apply for jobs that I didn't have a computer science degree.
Okay.
My primary defense was the school I went to didn't offer one.
Yep. Yep.
Now we're just showing our age, I think.
Right.
Old man Siegel didn't have a couldn't take a computer science course. I took computer science courses. I actually had the minor in college, right. But that was all I could get.
Right.
At my little liberal arts school.
Right.
Yeah.
So. Right. I think we've done that a couple of times. Also, so there's a current, okay, side point. There's a current meme on Twitter, I think, of going around and like, share your earliest video game memory that's going to age you without specifically, the people will be able to figure out what your age is without saying what your age is.
Mm-hmm.
So for you, your earliest memory would be what? Unless you want to skip this, you can skip this.
Oh my gosh, my earliest memory playing a computer game?
Yeah.
Oh boy. I remember that my brother and I super wanted an Atari,
yeah.
And my dad was worried that that was not educational and would rot our brains,
yeah.
And so instead got us a Texas Instruments TI-99/4A,
okay.
Which was, you know, being promoted by the very wholesome actor Bill Cosby at the time.
What a world.
Yeah. So I remember playing Munch Man on that, which was their ripoff of Pac-Man.
Okay.
Instead of eating dots, you created a chain. It was Pac-Man.
What a reversal. I do remember seeing Space Invaders in an arcade.
Okay.
I do remember I was very young, but I think I remember seeing Space Invaders.
Crazy.
In an arcade and being like oop eep oop eep and being pretty impressed by that actually.
We were talking about recalling like getting games in the back of a magazine by where they're in print and
right.
You had to type them in.
Right. Right. So I think for me that was like Color Computer, again another name for, have I said this on the show or am I thinking about before the show? So the earliest computer that I had, I have said this, right? TRS-80,
yeah.
Color Computer is what they call it. So Color Computer Magazine, you get the magazine and you'd have to type in the whole program in BASIC in order to run a fairly short text game.
Yeah.
But I was pretty dedicated to that, and that's where I first learned to program, frankly, and you know, fixing a bunch of syntax errors that I'd mistyped and things to look out for like that.
I mean, I feel like a lot of programmers started with, how can I use this machine to make it easier for me to run D&D?
Yeah. Yes.
Right?
Totally.
Yeah.
Totally.
I think a lot of us have done that.
Right. So even in TSR's Dragon magazine, right, they had a small number. There was actually a regular article called The Digital Eye,
The
Electronic Eye.
Yeah.
And they didn't have a lot of programs, but like twice they had a program for like the DM's assistant and an automatic character generator that, you know, I typed it in and spent many iterations trying to improve it actually over the years. And I think later on, I think I submitted a DM's helper program to Dragon magazine, and they were like, we don't do that anymore. Yeah, we don't do that anymore.
Oh, that's great.
So you know, it's interesting because I'm just going to talk about one of those. So Color Computer magazine had a trilogy of games. So over 3 months they had a trilogy of games called the Carrick series. Mm-hmm. And so Carrick was the Conan-like main character. So you had 1, 2, 3, and you type it in. I mean, you can see the data for what verbs are recognized and what nouns and what weapons are recognized. So having typed it in, you kind of have an idea about what the menu of options are, which actually helps you play the game. The third and final one, kind of like Module A4, kind of like Slave Pits of the Undercity, right, starts you off if you've been trapped and all your stuff's been taken away and you're just in a jail cell with the door closed.
Great.
You have nothing. How are you going to get out of it? And the clever thing is that in order to make the puzzle hard, they hid the correct series of commands in encrypted ASCII characters. So they had this one data field that was actually just what looked like a whole bunch of random data, but it was actually encrypted ASCII.
Okay.
And then to fool you, they had a bunch of red herrings about like, oh, look under the hay, and then there's a nail, and the nail can poke out a door hangs onto the wall by the hinges, right? The pin, right. So you can use the nail to poke out the pin. None of that helped you. Absolutely none of that helped you. So having typed it in, you try all those things. None of it helps you. And you're like, oh, what do I do now? Because it's actually hidden in the encrypted part.
That's funny.
Yeah.
That's funny.
Yeah. Which you actually typed in yourself, but you don't know what it says.
That's wild. So, Dan, what do you think of E3 here? Besides our own personal history in computer games, like now in your current position as a game master, as a streamer, an online streamer who talks about D&D all the time.
Right.
You know, what's your take on PAX East?
I'm experiencing that right now. PAX East. Very impressive. I actually haven't been to a convention here in Boston before, so I think it's very impressive. It's really kind of wild how this hobby is exploding. Again, that was this underground, got to keep it secret, got to keep it hidden from people that you know for decades, and now all of a sudden it's exploded, and here we are with tabletop stuff more taking over, taking some space away from the video game stuff, actually.
I mean, I feel like I've heard from multiple directions that the modern take on things is generally people are gravitating more or want the physical object as opposed to the digital.
Yeah.
Like, my wife is a librarian at a college, and oftentimes she deals with interlibrary loan, where sometimes they have to say, well, we can't actually get this book physically for you, but how about a PDF or how about an imaging or whatnot? And they get a lot of resistance to that because people want the physical book.
That's really interesting.
Yeah. And I think that's true. I've heard that true for D&D players as well, that they, a lot of them prefer the physical book, the physical dice to the online, like virtual tabletops or whatever, which is fine, right? I think a lot of us look at online play as like the second best thing, right? If you can't get everybody at a table together, then okay, the internet is actually goodish, at running D&D.
Agreed. And certainly, you know, things are easier, you know, using the internet, things are easier to access now is when we were young kids, you had to really pursue some of this stuff. You had to really fight, find out, like I remember looking through Yellow Pages, hunting for particular game products, scanning hobby stores, and you really had to go out and really hunt for things, possibly for months.
Yeah, I remember digging through, anytime I was at a new library, looking for what D&D books they might have. Like I said, I only learned about Pool of Radiance from an ad in the back of a Dragon magazine. Yeah, it was definitely harder to find information back then.
It's interesting, so as another analogy, in addition to the librarian type stuff, so my friends from the music world, that I know in New York, I mean, they're really heavy into getting LPs, right?
Yeah.
So they, the people that I know in bands, you know, the thing that really excites them is to release their music on LP. Mm-hmm. I don't know if this can continue, but bizarrely, LP sales have like doubled and doubled and doubled over the last 3 or 4 years or something like that. It's a really big deal, and it's, you know, it's an art object. It's a very nice piece of art that they can put up in their living room. To tell people about what their interests are and to remind themselves about that. It's a piece of art as well as an audio delivery format. I guess there was actually, just like a couple weeks ago, I guess there was an unfortunate fire in like one of the two main LP manufacturers. So actually at the moment, there's a big question about how the LP manufacturing industry is going to bounce back, as a matter of fact. Yeah. But you know, it's interesting. So to my understanding, and I might be wrong about this, but like, certain communities, like the Amish community, make a real dedicated effort about when a new piece of technology is available, does this bring people together, right? Is this a piece of technology? So my understanding is that the decision process really revolves around, is this going to be something that keeps people more separate, or is this going to be a technology that brings people together as a community? And so the examples that I've heard are cell phones and like TVs are no good because because a lot of us would sit down and watch TV alone. It's an alone thing. You're not communicating with other people about it.
Okay.
That's why TVs are prohibited, because it encourages solitary experience with a digital thing.
Okay.
Counterexample is big fancy barbecue sets. So supposedly. Supposedly, Amish people have a tendency to have really big, fancy barbecue, outdoor stoves with a lot of interesting features, because that's something where people are going to come around and join together, right, in a community meal, and we'll be talking and interacting, and so that's something that actually brings people more together. So it's interesting, and it's easy, and even if maybe I've totally misunderstood that, but... Even if I have, it's an interesting philosophical thesis to take, And it's really easy for me to get on board with something that tabletop stuff, bringing people to have more time live interacting, is enormously valuable in the world in this day and age. Yeah. And so for me to see more tabletop and more live role-playing stuff happen, I think it's actually a good sign for the world.
Interesting.
Yeah.
I definitely feel like that we've seen the current trend amongst tabletop game development is to emphasize the interaction and the simplicity of getting people around a table, right?
Right.
There's a stance I've taken in the past, which is maybe sometimes unpopular with fans of 4th edition D&D,
right,
that my impression of 4th edition was always that it was trying to directly compete with online games of the time, MMOs, World of Warcraft, etc., and that a lot of its mechanics are very much seem like the same as what was available on the digital side at that time, because they thought they were in direct competition with them.
Right.
And maybe they were in direct competition with those games,
right,
but I think the right strategy for being in competition with them is to emphasize what makes them different, right? Really say like, but this is, you get to actually talk with real people at a table face to face. There's physicality to it. They have dice in your hand that you're going to roll, right?
Yeah.
I felt like more of that would have been better.
Yeah.
And I do feel like 5th edition, that's the direction they've gone.
Yes. Yes. And you know, I remember one of the wizard staffers at the outset of 4th edition very explicitly saying that. Very explicitly saying, we're making the game more like World of Warcraft to attract the video game industry. And I really, the players, and I really wish that I'd saved that, because I can't track that down on the internet. And I've gotten some people express skepticism that that wasn't actually what was happening. And I really kick myself some days that I didn't record I didn't save a copy of the wizard staffers at the time explicitly saying that's what their goal was.
I mean, it's very easy from the outside looking into a company to assign a sort of uniformity of vision to a whole group.
Yeah,
right?
True.
Whereas it could very well be that there was not agreement on that point even
internally. Yeah, that's true. That's true.
But that's definitely true. I don't know. I definitely feel like 5th edition is more emphasizing, you know, the sort of ability of humans to just sort of roll with the punches and do crazy stuff and make it easier for people to just sit down and get playing.
Yeah.
Whereas 4th edition had a lot more complexity to it, which is great for the people that appeals to, but, you know, it was tough for people who are brand new to the hobby.
Yeah. Can I mention the Finch quote?
Is that,
okay. So we had the opportunity to briefly speak to Matt Finch a week ago at TotalCon, and he mentioned that his famous Primer to Old School Gaming that a lot of us point to, and he mentioned briefly, I hope this is okay that I mentioned that, sometimes he thinks about revising and making an updated version to it, because as he pointed out, the things that the Old School Primer was responding to at the end of 3rd edition are not quite so much as what you find in 5th edition anymore. So he said it's actually a little bit more scrambled up and vague, that the stark issues that he was pointing out with that, 5th edition's kind of moved a little bit back in the other direction again about those giving authority to the DM to be creative. And you're right, I think that everybody agrees that 5th edition has kind of moved in that direction.
Yeah, I think it has.
Yeah. And so actually, oh my God, there's so many comments. Old Man Lager, I think I'm saying that right.
Old Man Ledger, I think.
Ledger, right, thank you. Thank you. Is pointing out that the online gaming, the online streaming type games, really has just become viable very, very recently, like in the last 3 years or so. And that's a really good point. I mean, you know, we tried playing on Google Hangouts, years ago.
Great. Yep.
We did it once, and we were all like, I really like, you know, and we were all in different cities at that point, and I really like seeing you guys, but boy, it's really not enough of the experience to, it kind of would frustrate me of like, it kind of suggests the experience that I'm looking for, but not quite getting there. And you're right, obviously, we have just gotten into this in the last 2 years. And it does seem like there's a much greater opportunity now that the technology has become a lot more robust.
Do you think it's specifically the technology, or is it the introduction of streaming and the notion that there's an audience? how can you separate those two at all? Like, what's are more people playing online because they're playing to an audience and they're streaming, or are they playing online because the technology has enabled them to do so?
I would assume that you have better knowledge about this than I do. So I would actually bow to your what is your opinion about that?
I don't know. I mean, definitely the audience is an interesting factor. I find that, you know, I'm maybe what are we, 6 episodes into 10 Dead Rats,
yeah.
And I was ruminating to my wife the other day that I think that actually streaming has made me a better role player,
okay.
Or a better DM.
Okay.
Just because it's really forcing me to do some things, such as shut the hell up and listen to my players.
Okay.
Right?
Which,
and I'm doing that because I'm conscious that they're doing entertaining stuff and that there's an audience watching them,
right.
And I need to get out of the way.
Okay.
Whereas I feel like at just a tabletop with no audience.
Yeah.
You know, you're more likely to, well, let me dive in and kick the ball myself and get things moving.
Hypothetically, do you think that you would have had that same dynamic if you just taped yourself offline and watched yourself?
I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't think so. I think you need that conscious nag at the back of your head that says, you know, you have to be entertaining for these other people, these unknowns.
Yeah, screw them.
I mean, certainly that's the advice we've been given by a lot of different people about streaming, which is, first and foremost, make the game fun for yourself and your players.
Right.
So I don't know. So let me go back to the original question, which was, you know, is it the audience or is it the technology that has made online gaming more prevalent? Maybe I can't disentangle them, because actually the thing that I'm really drawn back to is the notion that by doing online streamed games where there is an audience, we are doing much better at teaching people how to play these games.
Yeah, I see that. And I can totally see, you know, look, if you're 80s, 90s, early thousands, and someone says there's this game called Dungeons and Dragons and it's played by people in their basement and it's got these weird dice you've never seen and you cast spells, right? I mean, I can totally see someone going, well, that's a cult. You've described some kind of like inhuman cult described.
Yeah.
Maybe. And these are people that, you know, none of my friends play, you know, and you have to really put yourself out in a situation that might seem somewhere between embarrassing, awkward, or sketchy. And the fact that now you can get a little bit of an introduction streaming online, you know, in the emotional safety of your own home. And then go, oh, I see what's going on. I would like to participate in that.
Yeah.
It's a much easier step. So as an outreach mechanism, I can totally see that making a huge amount of difference, as a matter of fact. A huge amount of difference.
I mean, the other thing I think that streaming has impacted is that, you know, necessity is the mother of invention, right?
Right.
So to enable people to make these shows, the technology is now improving. And now we have lots of choices for, well, what kind of video call? It's not just Google Hangouts, right?
Right.
Do you want to use Slack or Skype or, I don't know, what Zoom or what have
Discord
you?
Discord or...
Yeah, yeah. There's just
Twitch
so
or YouTube
much.
Or...
There's just so much.
Yeah.
There's
Mixer,
so many options.
Right? Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And then maybe the type of game you're running impacts that choice. Oh,
yes.
Are you battle mat heavy? Do you need a lot of tactics?
Yep.
Then maybe you
want to
use
a
virtual tabletop like Fantasy Grounds or what's the other big one? Roll20.
Yeah. Are you all live together at one table, or are you separated out with separate people streaming in? And that's going to modify. And so it's interesting, you start to have actual competition for that.
Oh, and then don't forget, we have stuff like D&D Beyond, where we have mechanized rule adjudication, right? So now everyone's got a device, and maybe it's much faster, much easier to quickly look up, you know, my stats, or what does a spell work, or, you know, I think that's really changed stuff.
Yeah.
To the point of like, well, now everyone's got a device anyway.
Yeah.
Like,
that's for me, that starts to impinge on DM, you know, authority. Not that the DM should be, you know, fascist, but that it starts to impinge on the DM being able to be creative about stuff that isn't in the rules.
But here's my point.
Yeah.
There was a while back where do you remember netbooks? Do you remember netbooks?
Sure.
The sort of pre-tablet.
Yeah.
They started coming out with these ridiculously tiny laptops called netbooks that were very cheap. And at that time I thought, oh, this will be an interesting tool to have behind the screen.
Right.
And I tried to run a D&D game with a netbook.
Okay.
And it was painful and unpleasant.
Okay.
And
I
quickly abandoned it.
Okay.
I was like, this is actually making my game slower, not faster.
Okay.
Right? That was the main goal. How do I make my game faster?
Right.
Like, I don't want to spend, like, for me, having players have a book in front of them and they're all flipping, that's the worst.
Right.
I don't ever want to see that in a game, and
Agreed.
I need to stop that. I especially don't want to be doing it myself.
Agreed.
Now we have D&D Beyond, and everyone's got a tablet or a laptop.
Right.
And frankly, it's just good. The software is good.
Okay.
To the point where, like, I don't have to flip or search or whatever. I just go tap.
Right.
There's the information I was looking for.
Okay. Okay.
And I think that's really, really changed the landscape.
Okay. Okay.
Partly it's good just for, like, you know, we have a very dense, heavy rule book with lots of rules in it. And now it's super easy to find exactly what you're looking for. That's great. That's just a helpful tool.
Right.
But now we've also gone the step of, now we're all used to having a digital device in front of us.
Right.
So maybe extending that to, and we're not in the same room and we're doing video is just a little easier.
Yeah.
Right? Maybe?
I would prefer the interaction of a human being talking
to me. Totally.
So I would prefer, in an ideal world, the DM would be talking to me and explaining stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And nobody would be looking up in media of any sort.
Maybe eventually.
It can't always be the case. Obviously, it can't always be the case. But
maybe eventually the technology gets to a point, and I can't imagine it, but maybe eventually the technology gets to a point where remote presence is as good as physical presence. But I don't think we're there yet.
Yeah, I mean, we've been saying that for at least 20 years.
Yeah. I mean, maybe it's not a thing that even happens in our lifetime.
Right.
But.
Right.
I could see it happening. I could imagine a world where it exists.
Occasionally, I like high-fiving another player.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Usually once a session, someone high-fives somebody else. And I don't know how that's going to be.
You know, there's
replicated.
One thing I think hugely missing from a lot of these online gaming, especially the video chat online gaming that I think both you and I have talked about, which is everyone getting to see the die roll. Right?
Yes. No. That's really huge to me. That was the main thing when we did last July. I came away wanting that, and disinvited ourselves. Well, everybody also said she wanted to see that.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. There's that great moment, right? Of like an important role comes up, and somebody rolls a die, and everyone leans in.
Right.
And you really want to
see
that.
Absolutely.
And so not being able to see that kind of sucks. Now.
Totally agreed.
I think at
some
point.
I'm surprised that more streams don't do that. Don't have a die. Tray camera.
Okay.
I mean, I guess we saw Acquisitions Incorporated do
that. Acquisitions Incorporated
did
do it.
Yeah.
And here's my pitch. I posted this to Twitter. Somebody please run with this idea. But what we need is a Kickstarter for a product that is basically a dice tray that has a little camera in it. And it connects to your computer as if it's like just a USB plug-in. It's a webcam.
Yeah.
And what it does is it coordinates with your webcam to give it a picture-in-picture view of your face and then in a smaller square, your dice tray.
Yeah. I would use that.
I would buy that.
I would
Somebody
use
make that.
That
thing.
Right.
I think we're this close to having it.
I would use that. Everybody at the table has their own.
Right. Well, that's.
Tray. Yeah.
I'm pitching this as a thing that helps us not all be at the table, right?
Gotcha.
When we're all remote, we call in with this special webcam that it has got a special picture-in-picture view of my own personal little dice tray.
Okay. Okay.
So that every player has in the corner their dice.
Yep. Yep.
Great. Maybe there's a button on it where you can flip-flop them because you're like, I'm going to make an important roll, so I want the big picture to be the dice and the small picture to be my face.
I might invest in that. and I make terrible money decisions, but I might invest in that, actually.
I think it would be
a great idea. That's a great idea. I mean, there's a lot of people making a lot of dice trays these days, so it seems like somebody ought to take that step.
The streamer dice tray. I don't know. It needs a snappy name. Let's debate the name for the next 6 months.
Well, okay, so a little behind the scenes thing. When Paul and I need to name anything, it either takes 5 seconds or 5 months, right? It's either it's right there or it goes on and on and on with great difficulty.
Yeah, naming things is hard.
Or extremely easy.
Dan, Ash wants to know, how can you fudge the dice rolls? How do you fudge the dice rolls, Dan?
I don't know where Ash lives. Currently, but I might be doing some research afterwards to go find him and slap him.
Yes, the answer, of course, is don't punch his dice rolls. Are you kidding me? Sorry.
Oh, what a great comment.
We kid because we love.
Yeah. It's true. Yes. Now the thing that that's one thing, but Despairy BB is complaining about Gygax's stream of consciousness chapter structure in first edition. Have you seen Zeroth Edition? that was the improved version.
Yeah.
But yeah, you're right. You're all right. Yeah.
Oh dear.
Yep. Yep.
Okay. All right. So video games. We're talking about video games today.
Oh right. Yes. Exactly. Right.
Any further thoughts on video games and as it relates to tabletop gaming?
Digital dice.
Yeah, digital dice. Oh, I've seen
those. That's the name for the tray.
Oh, okay. I thought you were talking about, now there's a product I've seen that are Bluetooth-enabled dice that when you roll them, it actually sends the result to your computer, so it does all the math, like you roll a fistful of these D6s and toss it, and it goes boop, and it gives you the total. Yeah, that exists. That's a thing. I've seen that. It's great.
What?
Yeah. Now each die is got a tiny Bluetooth receiver inside it, or transmitter, I would say. Yeah, yeah. That's a thing. I'm sure I'd have to go searching for it. It definitely exists. Maybe that's the thing that enables us to then I roll my dice and I have special software that shows the total that I rolled.
Yeah, I actually think that might be more. Well, someone can hack that.
Have you seen Google's new dice roll?
You can hack that and simulate it.
Yeah, probably.
I have, right in the regular Google search engine.
Yeah,
right?
If you just in the Google search engine type, 2D8 or whatever, it's actually really nice. I'm really happy about it because sometimes when I'm writing, if I'm like writing an adventure and I need to roll some dice, and I don't have dice in my pocket for some reason because I don't know, I'm an idiot and I forgot my dice that day, I then go, I'll just quickly get an online dice roller, and there's never a good one.
Yep.
And I usually end up back at like the one Wizards wrote like a decade ago.
Yeah.
For some reason, that one always comes up.
Yeah.
And it's not great. The Google one is fantastic. I'm really pleased with it.
Okay, that's good. So. There's a couple there's a couple very minimalist ones that I'm okay with for OD&D players. Like there's someone has OD&D DM's tools that has that, and then I actually have my own Super Dan mini dice, which is like the smallest thing I could possibly write that does that.
So what I like about the Google one is it does the 3D animation dice rolling, so it gives you a little bit of visceral feel, like I'm really rolling dice.
I agree.
Tallies up the total. Super easy to be like, add a die, remove a die, pop, 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 go, go.
Yeah.
Or just type into a box, I need, 13 D6 plus 7, go.
Yeah.
And it does it.
Yeah. That's nice. It's nice to have those things built into Google, actually.
Yeah.
Thank you, Google.
Yes. Yeah. I think it's one of the most valuable plugins they've made to their search engine yet.
Oh my God. We've been doing this for an hour, dude.
Oh, have we? Oh, jeez.
All right.
Let's wrap things up.
Oh God.
Because my battery is about to die.
Yeah.
Okay. Actually, we're not doing that bad.
Okay. All right. That's good for future purposes.
Final thoughts on video games and D&D.
Well, I think we'll probably need more episodes like this. Yeah. I guess this sort of just kind of scratched the surface because there's a lot more things about. I mean, we didn't talk about the general, history of tabletop games, spawning video games, which predate, which is, we're actually not old enough to have been part of that in the 60s to early 70s. So I feel like we ought to have an episode about that.
Sure.
I think we've just scratched the surface. We could have other, video game, professionals on possibly in the future if anybody's interested in that, talk about that.
That's a good point. Right? It would be nice to talk to some folks who have jumped the gap back and forth more than once of video game to traditional game design and back and forth.
So it's funny, we don't normally talk about this on the show because we're almost too close to it, right?
Yeah.
We're almost too close to the issue of video games to even think about how that affects our tabletop gaming. So
we probably should, though. We certainly have to. Background to talk about it.
You're right. So if you do want to hear more of us rapping about our video game tabletop gaming industry experience, please tell us that.
Yeah. Or if you've been involved in video game development or have thoughts about video games and tabletop games and how they've merged and bisected and crossed paths, definitely drop us some comments in the video here. We'd love to hear from you.
Or an interesting game that has fed into your tabletop play, or an interesting tool that we've overlooked that helped your tabletop game.
Yeah.
We're clearly on the lookout for that, and we're always trying new things, as a matter of fact.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So, as usual, you can find us, the Wandering DMs, on sites such as Twitter and Twitch and YouTube, always by the handle Wandering DMs. So please, if you haven't already, look for us there, and please like and follow and subscribe, and that does help us out quite a bit.
Our shows are also available in audio-only podcast form, which you can find on our website, wanderingdms.com. also on various podcast carriers such as Google Podcast or iTunes or a variety of others. If you are listening to this podcast on one of those carriers, please take a moment to rate and review us. That really helps us and helps others find our show.
It definitely does. And as always, thanks so much to everybody who commented on the show. It really feeds into the show quite a bit. And warm thanks to all of our patrons on patreon.com. You have made what we're currently doing possible, so thank you so much. If you would like to join our viewers in supporting the show, please go to patreon.com/wanderingdms, and you'll see how to do that.
Excellent. And Dan, what can they find as patrons? What special benefits are they going to get?
All kinds of stuff.
Yeah.
Paul.
Go on.
you'll be in the credits.
Yes.
At the end of the show. Yeah. You'll be seeing patrons there. There are special patrons-only access videos that we've released a number of times in the last couple of months.
Yeah, and we have some new ones in the works that we're talking about doing. So
we do.
We will see some more of those, I think, soon.
And at the topmost level, we will also work a promotion for whatever you do in gaming or related industries into the show. And we would be happy to support those who support us.
Awesome.
Yes. Awesome. As always, Paul, don't forget, we are live every Sunday at 1 p.m. Now, last week I made a mistake and I said that today was the day of the switch to daylight saving time here in the U.S. I was incorrect. That is correctly next week when that is. So we will be back next week, 1 p.m. Eastern daylight saving time. So look for that and set your watches and change the battery in your fire alarm.
Excellent. We'll see you then. Bye, everyone.